You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Just so you understand, we had a totally divided country for 8 years and long before that, in all fairness to President Obama, long before President Obama, we have had a very divided. I didn't come along and divide this country.
In fairness, he has only just started. As President Donald Trump prepares to address Congress for the first time, a new Gallup poll finds out what Americans are really worried about. My guests will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Russia's attempt to make sense and take advantage of the chaos of Donald Trump's first month and a bit in the White House, the countdown to Election Day in the Netherlands, where Geert Wilders hopes to profit from Trump's example, and... Bulgaria's state broadcaster is allowed to play modern pop music again after resolving a copyright dispute. But why did the old songs prove more popular? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London, Tom Edwards, Monocle 24's Executive Editor, and Thomas Lewis, Monocle 24's Toronto Bureau Chief, live in the flesh here in London. Welcome all, and we will start tonight in the United States, where for many decades, Gallup has regularly been polling on the question, what do you think is the most important problem facing this country today? Results are in for February 2017, and while there are no specific results for the one we elected in November, there is quite a big showing for dissatisfaction with government, amid a surprisingly diffuse set of answers. Kathleen, there's many interesting things about this poll, but the one that really struck me was if you look back over 8 years, dissatisfaction with government as a problem has increased vastly as the economy in general has decreased to almost exactly the same proportion. Does that tell us anything?
Possibly, possibly not. What has been common over the past 8 years and may be common now, is that a proper verb? I don't think so. Congress. I mean, the problem is dissatisfaction with Congress is sometimes, you know, used as dissatisfaction with everything else. On the one hand, if Congress does nothing, that's good if you don't like what they're going to do. On the other hand, if you would rather like them to do things, this is very bad. I don't know how much it has to do with the economy. That tends to be something else, I suspect. And there's a, I mean, obviously... commentators tend to assume that people assume that governments can take care of the economy. Probably in the United States, this is less relevant than it is in some European countries. There's a bit more disassociation. But it's funny, Trump's dissatisfaction thing. I mean, what's especially funny, and I don't, you probably won't want to follow this up, but his judging what he's going to say tonight and what has been ballooned out to us, this dissatisfaction will be met with a huge increase in military spending on the grounds that what people really don't like is America, quotation marks, losing wars all the time. So presumably, since most authoritarian governments, and indeed a lot of other governments, if there's problems at home, like dissatisfaction, they go for foreign affairs, and Trump may be actually laying the line for this. But in terms of dissatisfaction, of course, people, what's striking is the dissatisfaction with the economy is at the same time that the economy is going up.
Thomas Lewis, there were lots of quite, well, they surprised me anyway. Crime, for example, which was an absolutely dominant concern in 1997, barely registers now.
It's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that, you know, there is no one thing really that dominates. You know, I was in Pennsylvania in a town called Lancaster the eve of the inauguration. McCarthy, I don't know if you've been there yourself.
I know. I have.
That's Amish country, isn't it?
It is, exactly. And the town itself was fairly sort of blue, bluish purple, but, you know, Lancaster County was a very red place on election day in November. And what really struck me is that, you know, I went to a little dive bar called the Shamrock. I don't know if you've been there as well, Kathy.
Sadly, no.
I'll get you a drink there next time we're both in town. But what was so interesting is it was a very mixed place in terms of those people who voted for Hillary Clinton and those people who voted for Donald Trump. And these people were friends and, you know, went there regularly, drank all the time together. Politics wasn't the sort of great divider, really, that I think, you know, the narrative in a lot of the US media had sort of, you know, painted it to be. But I remember speaking to some of the Donald Trump voters there, and, you know, this was a couple of beers in, so I'll sort of give them that. But it really was remarkable to me that there was either they didn't want to or just frankly couldn't put any detail into why they'd voted for Trump, really, or B, what they expected him to do in office. It was the rhetoric seemed to be still so potent and so, you know, so alluring, I suppose, this bringing jobs back, this, you know, making America great again, obviously. But the fact that they didn't actually weren't relating that to the details of their own life. And one gentleman that really sticks in my mind particularly had worked in sheet metal, I think, for about 30 years. And he showed me his hands, and his hands were really in a bad way. You know, his knuckles were swollen. And he said, look, this is what hard work looks like. And, you know, it just struck me that, you know, for a man who has worked himself literally to the bone, you know, for all his life, who really put his entire sort of, you know, political future into Donald Trump, who couldn't really say exactly what he wanted Donald Trump to do.
It makes perfect sense for someone like that to vote for a billionaire trust fund baby.
With very smooth hands.
Hands as smooth as they are small. Tom Edwards, there was also in the new list of things people are worried about a small entry for us, which is to say the media. It's small, but it wasn't there at all 4 years ago. Now, does that tell us that Trump's media bashing is working or not working?
No, I think it explains to a degree some of the themes that everyone around this table has been talking about. A lot of the instinctive political reactions of the kind of people that Thomas was just talking about have been bent a bit out of shape by media agendas, but from right and from left. I think what you have to go back to is this idea that people think, and this picks up on what you were just saying, Andrew, about the anti-establishment 70-year-old white male billionaire. You know, if you're dissatisfied with government, why do you choose to display that at the ballot box by returning somebody with no political experience who you can be pretty sure is going to struggle with the niceties, and even more with getting on board the political machine? We've seen it in this country as well, where the people who were being left behind, as they like to said, were the turkeys that voted for Christmas in leaving the EU. That's going to do them a lot more harm than the so-called metropolitan elite liberal media city bubble in which we are all encased. So I think the problem you've got is there's a disconnect, which Thomas has identified already, between what affects people's lives from day to day and the role that politics plays at all. And I go back to a point I've made on this programme before, which is that it depends on personnel. It doesn't matter what we talk about, the crisis on the left or people shifting or, you know, populist rhetoric, this sort of thing. If you've got the personnel that can connect with people and it can galvanise movements that can still affect change. And at the moment in the US, on the right and on the left, you've got a real paucity of quality personnel. We have it in this country, and we're not going to make big strides until that's addressed, I think.
Well, I think one thing we ought to keep in mind is that Trump's support is from 40 to 44%, which means, through basic math, is that the majority is against what Trump's doing. So when you talk about the people, one really does have to ask, which people? And one also really has to ask, who normally does vote? The interesting thing to me, amongst about 19 interesting things for the last general election, was a lot of people voted who didn't vote normally. Mm-hmm. And Trump will have to satisfy those people to get them to vote the next time. And the difficulty is, what they wanted was a bull in the china shop. Everyone says, kick over Washington, get rid of drain the swamp, so forth, everything that's not happening, except kicking over Washington as well. Now, 4 years will show us if kicking over Washington produces anything that's recognizable. It has to do so. Otherwise, I do not think that Trump's so-called base is going to have the energy or the desire to go out and vote again.
That's why I think that's so interesting. You know, Donald Trump over the past few days has said, look, you know, I've achieved so much in, you know, my first month, achieved more than anyone's ever achieved ever in anything.
And so forth.
But what's he achieved? Nothing at all. He signed a couple of pieces of paper, basically, that have been sort of, you know, mocked and discussed and obviously have caused these huge protests and things. But like you say, it's the absolute concrete thing. This gentleman in Lancaster, if suddenly he doesn't get a pay rise in like a year or 2 years or 4 years, then, you know, how's he going to feel about Donald Trump?
Okay, well, we'll have all of tomorrow to dissect the runes scattered by Trump's speech later, which is something to look forward to.
We're going to take... here on the wrong night.
We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House. We shall be back after this.
Back in February 2007, 10 long years ago, the very first edition of Monocle magazine hit newsstands. A lot has happened in the decades since. From that first office in London's Boston Place, to seven fully staffed bureaux around the world. From the humble beginnings of Issue One to a media brand and business producing beautiful books, magazines, and 24/7 radio and podcasts, to a chain of Monocle shops selling original ranges and collaborations with our favourite brands, to Monocle films, events, and sellout annual conferences. Yes, a lot has happened, and the next chapters aren't written yet. Happy birthday, Monocle, and here's to the next 10 years.
Welcome back to Midori House, where we have traded in two Toms for one Robert, specifically Robert Fox, defence correspondent, or defence editor, I think I'm right in saying, of the Evening Standard here in London. We will move along a little bit, because further on Trump, his bloviate to Congress later will be watched intently around the world, but nowhere more so than Moscow, where, according to some analysts, those in power are starting to wonder if they back the right horse. So rather than waiting for Trump to orchestrate his promised revival of the US-Russia relationship, it might be the case that the Kremlin will instead seek to leverage the chaos of Trump's presidency into further advantage. Robert, first of all, where are you on the idea that Trump winning this election was actually a result for Russia? Wouldn't they have preferred the certainty and stability and predictability of Hillary Clinton?
Andrew, I think that you've got it absolutely right. He is looking less a good thing. They are selling shares, as the commentators are beginning to say. Because the one thing that is predictable about Trump is his unpredictability, and the Russians really don't like it. I think they...
Because unpredictability has been the market they've cornered in the last couple of years,
which
hasn't it?
Part of hybrid warfare.
Yeah,
and so on. Let's not get too theological and doctrinaire about it. But the interesting thing, I think, is quite a shocker, and I was just listening to your... apologies for lateness, but listening to your previous discussion, the thing that's really taking us aback is this hike in the defense budget. Now, it could be rat-like cunning, and it could be Trump just playing to a constituency he understands in his own head. But to go up by $56 billion, which is more than the British defense budget, which is the next biggest.
It's more than Russia's as well, obviously.
Exactly. And to say I'm going to put on 90,000 troops. Let's do that. Is this a trick to get round the employment issue? Because you actually get the boys and girls to join up in the more depressed areas. That is one question. But the other question, I think, which must worry the Russians, is the implication of the renewal of the nuclear arsenal. And it's like the Royal Navy and the British at the end of the 19th century. It is no false analogy, where the Navy had to have a fleet double the size of the next rival, and very likely the next two rivals put together. This is what Trump's nuclear doctrine seems to be saying. And there are great fears, which I'd like to come on to in a minute with another thing, about his belligerence. Sorry, Kevin.
No, not at all. I had something absolutely brilliant to say, but I got so caught by your rhetoric, I'm not sure I remember it. I think in terms of the defense budget, one wonders if Trump has the Washington nous, or indeed governmental nous, to ask for twice what he thinks he's going to get. There is absolutely no way he's going to get $54 billion.
Okay, yeah.
It's not only that you'd have to cut you know, you would have to bleed other programs. He doesn't mind bleeding environmental, for example. He doesn't mind bleeding a lot of other things, but he cannot bleed the 70% entitlement budget. But also, there's a number of budget hawks in Congress that's not going to like it either. So he's not going to get $54 billion. What we have to lay stakes on is he going to get 27? And what the other thing is, what can you do within 4 years with that amount of money? It takes much longer than that to get Indeed. To get things in line and to go. What's he going to do? Is he going to pay? And what are you going to do? You it's cyber warfare. Are you going to hire criminal hacks? It's who's going to teach them how to fight room by room and narrow alley by narrow alley? So where it's really needed, money is not irrelevant, but it's pretty far down the list of what you actually need.
Robert, you made reference earlier to Donald Trump's instinctive belligerence, which does seem to be a part of his personal and his political makeup. Trying to look at this optimistically from the point of view of somebody who lives in Western Europe, is it possible that that belligerence may actually cause Russia to be more cautious because they simply don't know how he's going to react if they, I don't know, attempt a cyber attack on Estonia or send a few little green men over the border into Latvia? But as you said, he's unpredictable. They don't know what he's going to do.
Well, living in Western Europe as I do and going into mainland Western Europe rather a lot, I'm very pessimistic. And I don't think the main point of effort will be Russia. And I think that Russia does get a buy and they kind of sense this. But what is worrying is that people who've got quite a good bill of health up to now, the military in the administration, Khalid Mattis and now McMaster, two of whom I know, what is worrying about them, and I praise their skill and they are intelligent people, but they do have obsessions. Both McMaster and Mattis are obsessed with Iran. And they've spoken of wanting to do Iran. What is scary, with recent intelligence coming to me, is there are many in the US Air Force that would like to do Iran. But they are telling the president, to get into the deep nuclear facilities, you're going to need tactical nuclear weapons. This is a really scary prospect. But I think that with the build-up, with the belligerence, which is the chest beating, which is second nature to Trump, I think we have three options for war scenarios. And that's why I was listening to Kathy. I think we're going to be really into the crisis of this presidency within 18 months. And what are the favorites? The favorites are Iran. Funnily enough, I don't think it's going to happen there. Very possibly North Korea, if it really does go nuclear and does something mad. But the likely candidate, because it's the war that we can manage, confront and win, and it is very worrying, is the South China Sea. Yeah. And this is, I am not speaking, there are people I greatly admire who at whose knee I have lived, like Professor Sir Michael Howard, who is a tutor of McMaster, Max Hastings, a correspondent of him. I spent a very fruitful but extremely depressing Friday with those two gentlemen. And they said both quite independently, we fear Trump wants a war.
Kathleen, just finally on this one, looking at what Russia can hope to accomplish from its own perspective while Trump is president, how far can you see Russia pushing their luck in the next 4 years?
Well, if Trump is wandering off in Iran, China, North Korea, quite a long way. Remember, the near abroad is meant to be the internal empire again. I wouldn't give Latvia's Ukraine's chance of not being nibbled away a bit more, for example. Estonia had better look to its forests. I think Putin, who has nothing to do really in the South China Sea, what does he care? Besides, there's a growing Russian Chinese, well, in fact, it's been there for a while, a sort of a tacit alliance almost. So while Trump was wandering off around the Far East and so forth, I think Putin will continue pressuring his western borders, the eastern borders of the EU, his southern borders. And if I were Sweden, I would worry an awful lot about the Baltics.
Okay, well, we're going to move along to the near abroad here in Europe. It is unusual for a Dutch election to attract much attention beyond the Netherlands borders, but these are not usual times. People unpersuaded that a revival of blood and soil nativism on the European continent is that smart an idea, all historical precedent considered, have been nervously watching the vigorous polling figures of the Party for Freedom, led, of course, by the charmless race-baiter Geert Wilders. Robert, most polls are putting the PVV about level with the VVD of the Prime Minister Mark Rutte. if that is borne out on election day, how seismic a result is this?
It'll be very important. It will be a shock to the self-regard of the Netherlands and the self-regard of the conclave that runs the EU, because I think that that is the bigger message. At the moment, can I put my hand where my heart or my mouth or my brain is? I don't see Geert Wilders becoming Prime Minister of the Netherlands. I think that Rutte is such a seasoned politician that they're going to get a concert party of a coalition to ensure that. But Wilders is but a symptom of a lot of what's gone before. Actually, he is working to the playbook of Pim Fortuyn, who was actually a much more accomplished politician, intriguing politician, very worrying. And the anti-Islamism, which we have seen with people like now Mrs. Neil Ferguson, Ayn Hassi Ali. So you get that tradition. What worries me, and you've very wisely pointed us towards a wonderful Guardian piece by Kees Mudder of he's a Dutchman and he writes from the United States, very, very bright. But Kees hasn't really gone into what has gone into this. And this is this huge change, this seismic, can you have a seismic loss of nerve, particularly in what is known as the Randstad, which is the rich west of the Netherlands. Sorry, I should declare, you must realize, I am in an Anglo-Dutch family. I have a Dutch wife. We've been married for 46 years, and our closest relations are our Dutch relations. And they are very, very worried indeed. And it is this pressure. And when you talk about them, and you talk about Islam, but when you talk to the bien-pensant even, what they talk about is Moroccans, would you believe it? And it's the presence of Moroccans coming into key centres like The Hague and Rotterdam over the past 15 years. And this is the thing that drove people like Theo van Gogh, who made a dreadful film with Ayn Hassi Ali. And it's very, very difficult. It is the Europe and the world of anti-globalisation I'm talking about psychologically. It's the world of walls.
Kathleen, as we've been pointing out, the chances of Wilders becoming Prime Minister of the Netherlands seem remote. Mark Rutte has categorically, irreversibly said 100% flat no chance he would go into coalition with him. If Wilders is therefore elected to Parliament as the head of a large, angry opposition bloc, what role will he or can he perform?
He will perform the role of a large, angry opposition bloc. The point is, he's not going to get over 50%. Therefore, he has to be in a coalition. All other 26 parties have said they will not be in coalition with him. It's quite odd, isn't it? I mean, he's part Indonesian himself. He dyes his hair blonde. You know, the sheer hypocrisy of the man is, quite wonderfully stunning. It depends on how embarrassed on election day the Dutch are, I think, as much as anything, to be known as the country which brought this sort of person, which even Austria didn't do.
It was a very tight squeeze.
But it was on the bien-pensant's good side, if you see what I mean. So I agree with everyone else. The idea that the Netherlands should, of all countries, should be going through this. We'll see Sweden next, and then the world really will come to an end.
Denmark and
Will indeed. All the liberal countries of which we have all looked as almost as models of right thinking and well acting.
Well, this was why the rise of Pim Fortuyn, I guess 15, 16 years ago, he was assassinated in 2002, was so intriguing to so many, Robert, that the Netherlands was always regarded as this liberal multicultural haven. And indeed, what was interesting about Fortuyn was that he tried to outflank multiculturalism from a liberal perspective. And I can remember reporting on that phenomenon shortly after he died. But does it strike you, as someone who knows the Netherlands far better than I do, that the debate in the Netherlands is especially rancid, or at least altered by the facts? And I wondered myself at the time, the Netherlands' physical smallness and its own geographical precariousness, the fact that it is literally below sea level, do these things amplify these kind of concerns?
Yes, it does, and particularly the smallness with regard to population. You're absolutely right. Fortuyn was a very, very different creature, an intriguing figure, because he was a brilliant, brilliant economist, and he was the first libertarian in economics, and all was not bad about that he spoke for. He was a much more brilliant and, in a way, much more dangerous figure would you believe it, than Geert Wilders. But Geert Wilders, sorry, going back to your Trump debate, we're with the P word again, aren't we? We're with populism. And this is a classic aspect of populism as defined by Case Mudd and his great colleague Jan Werner Muller, who you've had, I know, on Monaco. Populism seems to break out in three phenomena. The single leader, which is Wilders. There's nobody else in that party. The movement.
Well, we've seen the same thing with UKIP here. Yeah. They don't back down to number two.
The movement and the political party. And we don't really know what it is with Trump. It's a bit of the first two, not much party. This is the problem. But this is where I think Kathleen is right. I think this is a contagion. And the biggest threat, as I keep on saying, is to the solidarity of the EU and particularly the EMU. Because I think the Dutch may well come out of the euro as a result of this election campaign.
2 weeks till polling day. We'll be discussing that in greater detail as it approaches. But finally tonight, we have exciting news for Bulgarian fans of modern popular song, as the state broadcaster BNR can start once more playing music less than 70 years old, after resolving a copyright issue that had kept all post-1946 tunes from its airwaves for 2 months. However, during that period, BNR enjoyed a rise in ratings by 20% by some measures. Kathleen, have we arrived at proof here that they don't write them like they used to?
Well, yes and no. It's quite striking when I learned we were going to chat about this tonight. I immediately went to Google and wrote in Bulgarian music. And what I got was a whole series of 10 greatest songs, interesting looking people singing, but nothing about classical music is really more popular in Bulgaria than Bulgarian folk songs. Well, folk songs, there, that's all right, Bulgarian pop music. Well, I'm a classical music person myself, and I could always just say sustained quality comes out at the end. You probably wouldn't agree with that, Andrew.
Well, I would agree to an extent. I'm not a classical music fan. I tend to prefer music made by, you know, dead Americans with beards and guitars in Nashville in about the early 70s. But like most people...
Your beard's gone.
Well, exactly. But like most people, Robert, I tend to hold that basically popular music ceased to be of any interest as an art form more or less exactly on my 35th birthday. The popularity of the old songs we're seeing in Bulgaria, is it possibly a reflection of the fact that young people just don't listen to the radio anymore?
No, I don't think it's necessarily that, from what I can recall. I did a lot of the Balkans in the 90s and the noughties, but particularly the 90s, where particularly the further west you've got, you are absolutely just... it was numbing. The plague, and I can only call it the plague, of folk turbo rock. Which covered everything.
Serbian turbo folk, I remember vividly myself from approximately that period, Belgrade in the early 2000s.
Absolutely. And they haven't really, I suspect from this, we're learning they haven't got through that, and it had a neuralgic effect on them. But the other thing that has to be said, that contemporary accessible classical music, Björk and so on, is absolutely terrific. I've been listening to two discs recently, one by two outstanding sopranos, Renny Fleming and Anne-Sophie von Otter, of 20th and 21st century classical music. It's absolutely terrific.
I mean, do mainstream broadcasters now, Kathleen, do you think they overemphasize the now? Are they mistaken in assuming that their listeners have no historical interests and no sort of understanding of the hinterland that made modern music what it is?
Well, I think they're driven by the idea of being ahead of trend, aren't they? Ahead of curve, as much as anything. The odd DJ I know, and they aren't many, if I may say so, are very aware of the hinterland, but they're not convinced that their listeners care, if you see what I mean. I mean, think, how old would you be without 1964 and the Beatles and their four top ones in the American Hit Parade? That's a long time ago.
It's there with Schubert now, aren't they?
Well, exactly. So that's not... So the point I'm trying to say is that if rock and pop base part of their appeal on being new and breakthrough and so forth... break back is not an argument for it.
No, you can terrify yourself half to death with this arithmetic, though, because the first Beatles album came out in 63, so that's, what, 54 years ago. 54 years before that, the First World War hadn't started and nobody in the world owned an electric guitar.
That's right, and it's even older than you, Andrew.
So, Robert, just finally, do you have a particular favourite pre-World War II Bulgarian artist?
No, I don't. But the thing is, we should also mention Crossover, and my favourite is clean bandit, which apparently is a Ukrainian expression for a mafioso.
On that note, literally, in fact, that is all we have time for today. Kathleen Burke and Robert Fox, thanks very much for joining me at Midori House. Also to Tom Edwards and Thomas Lewis, who were in earlier. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's music next, possibly not very much of which was recorded in Bulgaria before 1946. At 1900, it's Monocle's Design Show, Section D, and there's more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow, London time. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.